arguments, we'll go ahead and announce it. We've gotten more formal in our announcements because, as you may know, we are recording arguments, so don't say anything that you don't want recorded for posterity. And on the bright side, you'll be able to pull the recording of the argument off of our website at some point. So we will call Texas Department of Motor Vehicles et al. Versus Fry Auto Services et al. Cause number 0317-00034-CB. For those of you new to third court, which I don't believe any of you are, you'll have 20 minutes allocated to argue. I think you've had a chance to talk to the clerk about how you're going to divide your time. And as I understand, we're going to reserve 5 minutes for the appellant's rebuttal here today. We have time warning system, lights to help you keep track of your timing. When you see the yellow light come on, you have 2 minutes left. When you see the red light come on, you're out of time and need to look to the court for further additional time, which we will try to grant you as justified. And by way of housekeeping, if anyone in the audience has a cell phone, pager, or other device, now would be a good time to reach down and turn it off so it doesn't go off and disturb our litigants. And with that, we'll hear from the attorneys in the DMV case.
May it please the court, Ari Kunin from the Solicitor General's Office for Appellants.
Morning, Mr. Kunin.
Morning. Plaintiffs challenge the regulatory scheme that governs commercial access to the state's auto title and registration system. Apart from plaintiffs' narrow procedural challenge to those rules under the APA, there is no jurisdiction over plaintiffs' claims. Specifically, three categories of claims must be dismissed. First, the constitutional challenges to the statute making the DMV responsible for regulating access to the system, because plaintiffs have no viable constitutional claim. Second, the related ultra vires claim against the named official defendants for making the disputed rules, because the ultra vires claim is redundant of any APA challenge. And third, the claim that the contract addendum required to access the system is an invalid rule under the APA because the contract addendum is not a rule. Turning first to Patel, which is the cornerstone of plaintiff's constitutional challenge. The Patel claim is not viable and categorically barred. It must be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction for two reasons. First, Patel's economic liberty right applies to individuals, not business entities. And second, plaintiffs do not assert an economic liberty interest that is governed by Patel.
It would be helpful for us if we don't use Patel as a shorthand, because I don't know that it's defined enough or been developed enough for us to really get much benefit from that. If you could also talk in terms of, I mean, it seems to me the big question here is the jurisdictional question and whether there's some sort of a vested interest or right of some sort that's required to trigger jurisdiction there. Isn't that correct?
I think that gets to the heart of it, Your Honor. There is no inherent right that plaintiffs have to advance here under the due course of law clause. Plaintiffs rely on an economic liberty interest, and for that proposition, they rely on Patel.
What about the right to contract with their consumers?
That is not the relevant inquiry under Patel. Patel covers economic regulation. This is not economic regulation here. This is setting the terms of access to a government system that plaintiffs use to provide a public function for profit. This is the using the government's own property, the government's own system, to provide that public function.
And where do we look to you to find that that doesn't give them a vested interest or a property interest sufficient to maintain a constitutional challenge?
Well, Your Honor, I think the inescapable fact is that this is indisputably a public function, and the plaintiffs don't contest that titling and registering automobiles is an exclusively governmental function. This is not something like the eyebrow threading in Patel that theoretically exists outside of an agreement to provide a government service for profit. The Constitution does not protect any economic liberty right to provide a public service using government property for a guaranteed profit.
How does the TEA case fit in, and what's the relevance of what the Supremes are hearing on that?
Your Honor,
this is the charter school case that the Supremes recently argued that came out of this court.
I believe that's addressed in the briefing. I'm not prepared to address it in further detail at this time, but I think that, if I recall correctly, falls into a category of several other circumstances, including the Medicaid provider cases that involve providing a governmental, that involve providing a service for which there is no constitutional right to any sort of guaranteed profit, any guaranteed business model. But that's exactly the type of right that the plaintiffs here would like to constitutionalize, to guarantee the continued profit from their mere expectation interest of a particular business model. And that's not an interest protected by the Constitution.
Isn't the difference here, though, that the government's not just regulating what this vendor can charge for the actual government service, but they're actually limiting what the vendor can charge to a private person that contracts to obtain the government service from the vendor? I mean, isn't that the distinction here? Between just your run-of-the-mill, this is a government contractor and they serve at the will of the government, isn't the difference here that the agency has come in and actually told a private party what it can charge another private party?
I think the best way to answer that, Your Honor, would be to look at the total service that is provided in this instance, which is ultimately title and registration services that are a government function. And the government surely must be able to control what the public is charged for what is an entirely governmental service.
Well, yes and no. I mean, if each county has a place where a person can go and get from the actual government entity, I can go and pay $10 for X. But I could also, without taking a number and being number 1,000 in line, go to a vendor over here and pay them $100. A lot of people will do that. Why can the government come in and say, I'm sorry, vendor, you can't do that. You can't allow a person to pay what a willing consumer is willing to pay?
I think that point gets to plaintiff's suggestion that this is just a free market question. This is a market determined price, and what the market will bear should be the price. But this is not a market good. This is ultimately a required service by the government, and there is an interest in not only capping what the public is charged for that service, but also concerns of uniformity, transparency, accountability, some proportionality to what the public is ultimately going to pay versus what the actual underlying service costs, what the service is charged by the government. Now, but those questions, you don't even get to those questions, because the threshold is whether there is an economic liberty interest in the first place. And if plaintiffs claim, as I understand it, is that they merely expected to continue a particular business model, essentially at sufferance through the acquiescence of a handful of tax collectors in a handful of counties, that system was not only opaque and almost ad hoc and informal, but just merely lacked statutory authority to begin with. The return to that is not protected by the Texas Constitution, because their claim is ultimately based on a constitutional right to the profitability of what they would like to continue as their business model. If I could give an example as an analogy, consider a court that, instead of requiring paper filings, is now going to let people e-file, and it will actually require e-filing. The court could certainly set up its own e-filing system, but it might also let private companies, private vendors, provide e-filing services to the public. Surely the court must be able to retain the ability to regulate the terms of access to that e-filing system and also the prices that the public ultimately pays for e-filing services. But plaintiff's argument, if accepted, would strip a court of that ability in that situation.
Would it make any difference in your example, though, if the court also accepted the filings? And so people could choose whether they were going to go to the third party or whether they're going to file directly to the court, which seems to be more analogous to the situation here.
There are, Your Honor, I believe that's one example of a way that a court could structure a system like that. But ultimately, this is about whether the court can regulate terms, including prices, that the public is ultimately charged for that service. So the question is not whether the actual prices and the fine-grained details of that system, how they play out. It's about whether there's an underlying economic liberty interest under the Texas Constitution, under the Due Course of Law Clause, to when the court would like to regulate that access and regulate the price. Do the vendors then get to say, no, we have an unlimited right to charge what we believe the market will charge?
Could it also be analogous to, say, a publication company where the court releases its opinions electronically online, but they also allow an electronic vendor to take those opinions and convert them into a product that they in turn sell for a price that the market will or will not bear, you know, call it like West?
I think that that could be an example. There are probably several examples where the government is involved in some sort of arrangement where private vendors are providing some sort of service, but the ultimate
at a price that the market will bear.
Well, Your Honor, at the price that the market will bear is not really the ultimate question, because
but
you have to.
Can the legislature then come in and regulate that provider at a later date?
So.
And say, well, yeah, you can get those opinions and you can put them in books, but you can only charge $1 a book.
I'm not sure all the ways that hypothetical plays out, but I think here the relevant question is whether, when you're talking about titling and registration automobile and registering automobiles, that no one disputes that is an exclusively governmental function, and when the legislature through the DMV would like to regulate what the public's ultimately charged for that function, that doesn't violate an economic liberty interest, an inherent economic liberty interest under the Due Course of Law Clause.
That seems like a much easier question once you reach the merits, but at the jurisdictional stage, it's a little more murky. I think that's where your time's probably best spent leading this.
I don't think that that's a merits question, though, Your Honor, because it gets to the viability of the claim, the non-viability of the claim, which is still a requirement. If these claims are categorically barred, they're jurisdictionally barred, and they have to be dismissed. That's not a merits inquiry into whether the regulations are oppressive or not. This is about, one, whether corporate entities have economic liberty rights that Patel said were inherent in individual persons. We argue they do not. And that the economic liberty interest here is alleged to be an economic liberty interest in continuing to provide a governmental service for an expected profit, not a guaranteed profit. This is not a takings claim, for example. We're not arguing that, for example, corporate entities are without rights. It's just that the particular right on which plaintiffs are relying is the economic liberty right recognized in the Patel case, which is inherent in individuals. And as the Supreme Court indicated in the Texas Small Tobacco Coalition case, Patel and its principles ought to be limited to the particular legal framework in which it arose. So this court should not expand that economic liberty principle inherent in individuals further to cover the entities here.
Didn't the TEL also include the entities like the salons?
But, Your Honor, I think the quickest way to answer that is that the Patel plaintiffs that actually were recognized their economic liberty right, these are individuals. There is no barrier to entry here like there was in Patel. Plaintiffs are not alleging that they're being, that they've been put out of business. This is merely an expectation to continue receiving additional revenue. That's not a constitutionally protected interest. So if I could just turn briefly to the remaining claims. The claims other than the APA 038 challenge should be dismissed, including their constitutional challenges, as well as their ultra vires claim against the named official defendants, which are purely redundant of any APA challenge to the rules, which we agree there is jurisdiction to consider on remand, that narrow claim. And finally, the contract addendum claim that merely governs the terms of access of the government's own property. It's not a rule under the APA, and it implements no rights until and unless it is accepted for consideration. It cannot be a rule, and therefore cannot trigger the narrow jurisdictional waiver under the APA.
And the decision of whether it is a rule, is that in itself jurisdictional?
It is, Your Honor. I think the Slay case might be one good example of that. It is a jurisdictional requirement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keene. Morning, Mr. Elsar.
May it please the court, my name is Bill Elshire for the appellees. Jurisdiction and applicability of the sovereign immunity is the sole issue in this interlocutory appeal of a rule challenge case in which no discovery has occurred and no full record has been developed. The law is clear that sovereign immunity is inapplicable with a suit such as this that challenges the constitutionality of a statute or a rule and seeks only equitable relief. Much of what Texas DMV presents in arguments are arguments on the merits of the plaintiff's constitutional claims and arguments against applying the Patel standard of review to judge the constitutionality of the Texas DMV's new price regulations. The state erroneously claims that these plaintiffs have no constitutional protection at all that could possibly apply to them, yet Texas DMV does not claim that there's a lack of a plaintiff standing to bring their non-constitutional claims under the rule challenge under 2001-038 of the Texas Government Code, which is limited to plaintiffs who allege that the rule interferes with or threatens to interfere with a legal right or privilege of the plaintiff. In spite of their status as a private business performing a governmental function, they have standing to bring a 2001-038 rule challenge of non-constitutional claims. They have a standing to bring constitutional claims as well. For its jurisdictional argument against the viability of plaintiffs' constitutional claims, Texas DMV relies on Andrade versus NAACP of Austin in their brief at page 13, a case that was distinguished by the Supreme Court in Patel at page 77. The court said, Andrade stands for the unremarkable principle that claims against state officials, like all claims, must be properly pleaded in order to be maintained, not that such claims must be viable on their merits to negate immunity.
Let me interrupt you. The difficulty here, it seems to me, is what legal right do your clients have if the government had just decided, you know what, we're not going to allow deputizing anymore at all? Is there a constitutional right at that point?
Not necessarily. In fact, one of the points that I plan to make.
I'd rather you go ahead and make it now.
I think I can. Thank you, Your Honor. While the charging of the official fees is a statutory public function, the agreement between plaintiffs and their customers is a private contract transaction. Can the government regulate that? And in answer to Justice Goodwin's earlier question as well, yes, they can. But they have to be reasonable and it has to be justified. That's the role that Patel has. It's not recognizing a new right. It's recognizing a standard of review when the government regulates, what the court in Patel says is a pre-existing right, liberty interest, to pursue one's livelihood and to pursue a job. And it doesn't just say in the private sector as well. So yes, the government could regulate this. The government might be able to even do what they've done in this case, but they've got to be reasonable and it's got to be justified. Most importantly, and the reason we're here today, is the courts have jurisdiction to hear that claim.
To decide if it's reasonable or justified.
That's right.
So to clarify, they could take away the ability to do this, provide this service at all, and there's no constitutional claim that could be had, but once they allow it to continue, that's where the claim arises.
I answer in the affirmative with this qualification when you say they.
Government.
Yeah. The legislature might be able to do that. They've got to do it properly, which is why we brought our standardless delegation claim. I'm not so sure that Texas DMV could just do that just because they decided to provide equipment that is necessary for the transaction. I don't know that they can use the authority to lease equipment to abolish a local decision.
The legislature could take this ability to provide the service away.
They could, and I believe that it's possible that the tax collector and the county commissioner's court could do so. They have sanctioned this. In fact, they oppose these rules in the counties where we're here. So
I'd ask before if there's any analogy there to that TEA charter school case. It rings similar.
Your Honor, I made a note that I need to go look at that case as soon as I get out of here. I'm sorry.
Can I ask you about the ultra-virus claim? I mean, does it stand or fall on whether or not the statute enacted by the legislature is constitutional?
Absolutely. And that's the point that they've missed about the ultra-virus claim. It is pled as contingent on a court finding that Section 520.0071 is a standardless delegation of a new function for Texas DMV to regulate the prices that my clients charge to their customers, not the fees, but the prices. And so if, because, and in fact, let me turn, if I can, to that point, the in their brief at page 26, Texas DMV cites Ex parte Elliott for the proposition that fixing rates, which is how they characterize what they're doing here, is appropriately delegated by the legislature. But if you look at Ex parte Elliott, 973 Southwest 2nd, 737 at 741, what it actually says is the power to fix rates within prescribed limits to cover specified items of cost may be delegated. There are no prescribed limits in Section 520.0071, the delegation to set the prices that plaintiffs may charge. It's just a bald delegation to say, go set their prices. That's not a sufficient guidance, even though setting rates might be delegated by the legislature to an administrative agency. They still have to give them some guidance. So if that's invalid, and only if that's invalid, is there an ultra-virus claim? Because then the board lacked the authority to adopt the rules that 520.0071 said they can adopt. And that's the contingent fee there. Now, speak to the issue about business entities and rights. It's true that almost every one of these plaintiffs are incorporated businesses, but nothing in Patel or in this court's subsequent opinions says that business entities lack the protections of contract or of economic liberty under Article 1, Section 19 of the Texas Constitution, which is recognized as also incorporating the rights under the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The Texas Alcoholic...
Is that a standing issue, or is that to the viability?
The Texas DMV has tried to make... It has argued that as a jurisdictional issue. And as I understand their argument, they're saying these constitutional rights don't apply. It's almost a merits argument. These constitutional rights don't apply to these plaintiffs. Therefore, the court doesn't have jurisdiction to hear it. And so it is important, I suppose, it's sort of like deciding if the contract addendum is in fact a rule because it interferes in the rights that we assert that we have, allowing more inspection of their rights, foregoing any, waiving any rights to bring claims against them if they shut off their business. But this court, the TABC, made exactly that same argument in the Live Oak Brewery case that this court had recently. And last month, this court implicitly rejected that argument and analyzed the applicability of Article 1, Section 19 protections to the brewing company. And I would also note that Live Oak Brewing came to this court with a full summary judgment record after discovery was conducted and without any issue being raised, even sua sponte, about jurisdiction. Likewise, as cited in the Live Oak Brewing decision by this court, in 2016, your sister court in Houston applied the Patel standard to a corporation's substantive due process claim under Article 1, Section 19. That's the Gates Co. QM Limited v. City of Austin, City of Houston, 503 Southwest 3rd, 607, and a federal court in Old Dominion Dairy Products versus Secretary of Defense, 631 F. 2nd, 953, found for a corporation's right of, quote, contract to contract and engage in the common occupations of life as having, quote, no lesser protection under the U.S. Constitution than an individual to engage in such pursuits. Under applicable standards, when a government unreasonably interferes in a business, economic liberty, or freedom of contract, our courts have jurisdiction to hear those claims and judge the constitutionality of those regulations under the Patel standard. That's all Patel means at the stage we're at. Now, as I admit, that this case is a bit unusual in that plaintiffs are private companies with all the problems and challenges of any other private business, but who are deputized and licensed to perform a governmental function or of vehicle registration and titling, but only for customers who choose to use their services for an extra charge instead of having their vehicle transactions done more cheaply at the county tax office or at the county satellite tax offices. In both of these counties, they don't just have one office that the public could choose to go to. Now, under these circumstances, the plaintiff's performance of a governmental function sandwiched inside a purely private sector competitive market does not negate their constitutional rights any more than would such rights automatically not exist for others who perform public functions. Under Texas DMV's reasoning, no court would even have jurisdiction to hear a public servant's substantive due process claim, no matter how unreasonable or oppressive the government regulation was on them, merely because they're performing a governmental function. The liberty interest to pursue an occupation or livelihood discussed in Patel and other cases is not limited to those jobs in the private sector. These plaintiffs get no public funding. If these companies make money at all, it's only because they successfully attracted customers from the private sector who were willing to pay extra for their convenience. And to get a vehicle registration or title, no vehicle owner in Texas is required to use my client's businesses. Their Texas DMV's argument about whether plaintiffs are claiming entitlement to some level of profit or a certain business model misses the point of what the reviewing court focuses on in a substantive due process case. And again, Your Honor, I recognize that this tips over into the merits, but the way they've structured their argument, it's difficult not to address that as it, in the jurisdictional context they've raised it. But Patel notes that the freedom, the economic liberty of Texas citizens and businesses pre-exists the Constitution, and it is government who must justify in court its interference in that freedom. Certainly, the cosmetology statutes and rules in Patel may have had some small effect on the bottom line of the eyebrow-threading companies, but the size of those lost profits was not the focus of the court. The court's focus is properly on the unreasonableness of the government's action if it interferes at all with economic liberty. From a practical business standpoint, the deputization of these my clients' businesses does not guarantee these clients any business at all. No one has to go use their business, but merely gives them an opportunity to invest their own funds to, in essence, compete with the tax office for each of their customers by purchasing or renting locations for that customers find convenient and employing sufficient competent staff to provide exceptional service so they'll come back. For decades, taxpayers generally have benefited from this arrangement because without reducing the state or county treasury revenue from registration and titling fees at all, 100% of which are transmitted daily to the tax offices, the tax office is able to avoid millions of dollars in processing expense if they had to perform these transactions in additional county office space with additional county employees. Now, under the right circumstances, the state, or at least the local tax collector, as I said, can regulate these plaintiffs' businesses, but they must do so subject to the Patel standards and to be reviewed as to whether they're justified and reasonable.
Do you really need the novel Patel economic liberty, or are there other constitutional bases that your clients can rely on?
The freedom of contract, I think, is the core.
I mean, everybody's putting a lot of weight in Patel, but Patel, I think, is still being sort of filled out as far as where its contours lie.
I view Patel in the context of this case is giving us the basic test that would be used if you go look at whether or not these rights are implicated, or whether or not you would look to whether or not, for example, there is evidence that by the state regulating the price that my clients and their customers agree to it does that evidence demonstrate that it would actually advance a legitimate governmental interest, and does that and does not place an oppressive burden on the plaintiffs. That's the Patel test of the rule itself. We're not there yet. This is jurisdiction. Can we even get our day in court with the authority that we have? And I think that the right to contract in a private transaction, voluntary on both sides, at a price, is the right under the Constitution that is most implicated. Can my clients pursue a liberty interest, to pursue a livelihood and so forth? Yes, but it's not what I would emphasize. I would emphasize that aspect. And that doesn't come from Patel. That's long held. In fact, I guess there are some courts that might consider a right of contract some kind of property right. There's been a lot of briefing by Texas DMV on whether or not we have a vested property right. It is not necessary for us to, for a corporation under these circumstances, to only have a vested property right for the court to have jurisdiction to hear our claims. Article 1, Section 19 has other rights besides just property rights. It has the liberty interest that was discussed in Patel. It includes the right of contract.
Is there a partnership involved in this litigation? I mean, not that that makes that much of a difference, but is there, I mean, are they all corporate entities?
No. Some of them are simple partnerships. They're all businesses. Have an assumed name, but no, there's at least one of these businesses that is not a corporation and is not a limited partnership. It's just a simple partnership.
do you agree, though, that on the typical standard due process claim that we're used to looking at, there needs to be some sort of a vested property right to bring that claim?
Certainly a vested property right is probably the most prevalent that you would find, but no, I don't believe that it is necessary for my clients to demonstrate that they have a vested property right in order to assert rights under Article 1, Section 19, unless you consider the right to contract with their customers to be some kind of property right. I think they have that right. And they have a right to pursue their business. They don't have an unlimited right to pursue their business. They have a right to pursue their business without unreasonable and oppressive government interference. That's what Patel's lesson is to us. I am not argued and have not argued that it can't be regulated. It just can't be unreasonable. And they set fees, not to get into the merits, but the record shows they set fees that are all lower for our clients than what had been agreed to with the customers for years, for decades, without the government interfering. There is also an issue as to where we are now and whether it would be appropriate for the court to accept the invitation from Texas DMV and start looking into the merits of the constitutional claims at this point, considering the limited record that we already have available for us. The court in Patel and this court in recent Alabon versus Freshour, I found it at 2017 Westlaw 566-3607, recognizing the court and Patel said, although whether a law is unconstitutional is a question of law, the determination will in most instances require the reviewing court to consider the entire record, including evidence offered by the parties. We don't have that full record before us, even for you to all to look at, to decide whether or not there's merits to the constitutional claims or whether they actually apply, and therefore there's jurisdiction, which seems to be the argument from Texas DMV.
And I guess that hinges on the viability prong that they talked about in Patel.
Yes. But the concept that the courts look to actual evidence in challenge to the constitutionality of government regulations is not new law. In 1968, this court said in Humble Oil versus City of Georgetown, 428 Southwest 2nd 405, that sometimes the reasonableness or unreasonableness of a law may appear on its face, but in other cases, quote, the question may depend upon their operation upon particular persons or conditions of fact which cannot be known to the court until made to appear by evidence. So please note that the Humble Oil case was a case about a government regulation of a business entity in which the government tried to restrict the size of gasoline storage tanks Humble could use, and this court saw that such restrictions could implicate the fundamental rights of that business entity. So after the Supreme Court in Patel clarified the standard of review for such constitutional challenges, courts need a fuller record to avoid the blind deference to government official regulation, particularly where there is no actual evidence that the rule will accomplish the claimed governmental purpose, and especially when we're involved with economic activity. And if price controls is not regulation of economic activity, I don't know what is.
Thank you, Mr. Ailes.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, Mr. Pena.
Plaintiffs ultimately are relying on an economic liberty interest for their Patel claim. If I could read from their appellee's brief, this is, quote, Texas DMV argues that jurisdiction does not exist because plaintiffs cannot prove they have a vested property interest for their constitutional claims. But a vested property interest is not the claim plaintiffs pled. That's page 15 of appellee's brief. Plaintiffs say they are relying on the liberty and privilege to pursue a business and earn an honest living. That is the right plaintiffs are hanging their hat on. And that right was most recently succinctly discussed in the Patel case. Now they come here today and try to avoid that principle because there is no economic liberty right when the government regulates its own property and the price to access that service. They mentioned freedom of contract, which is not implicated for the reasons discussed in our briefing. That's not a viable constitutional claim at all, and yet here today they argue that now all of a sudden their economic liberty interest claim under the due course of law clause is reliant on some sort of contractual interest. The court should look at our briefing. That's fairly well covered there. But taking a step back, Patel is about the liberty to compete on an open playing field in the market. Plaintiffs in this case are essentially government contractors providing a government service for profit, and they concede could be cut off at any time totally. That ability implies the lesser power to regulate costs for receiving that service. And that case makes this case fundamentally different than any sort of economic liberty interest under the due course of law clause. Plaintiffs cannot overcome a fundamental flaw in this case. They are allowed to provide a public service and be paid for it only by statute. They have no inherent right to vindicate, and that's why in our briefing we've covered the field. If plaintiffs want to rely on an economic liberty right, and they cite Patel for that proposition, that claim fails for two independent reasons. These companies don't have inherent rights to vindicate, and they're trying to vindicate a right that is not an inherent economic liberty interest because it's just about providing a public service using government property. And if plaintiffs now want to rely on the theory that they have some vested property right that is a longstanding requirement to have jurisdiction under a substantive due process claim, there is no vested property right in providing a service that could be cut off at any time that relies on access to this government system. So the plaintiffs are wrong that sovereign immunity is irrelevant. They are wrong that these are somehow merits questions. This gets to the heart of whether there is an interest to protect at all in the first place. And the real substance of their claim is that their revenues are going to be impeded. They are not asserting a barrier to entry. They are not asserting they've been put out of business. This is not about individual people somehow being prohibited from putting their labor to use for economic gain. This is about the companies here seeking access, unlimited pricing, essentially, for providing these government services to the public. And a few remaining points. This court, even post-Patel and post-Andrade, has continued to recognize that viability and the need for a vested property right are jurisdictional. The American Youth Works case, for example, these are cases cited at pages 4 and 5 of our reply brief, might be the best examples, as well as our discussion of Gates Go and Old Dominion. Those are not economic liberty rights, and we're not arguing that that companies are simply without rights altogether. It's just the court has to look at the actual right that plaintiffs are relying on, and it's not there. If there are no further questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Keenan. Mr. Aylshire, interesting case, well presented this morning. The case will be submitted, and the court will stand at recess.
All right.